Hello, I'm Fanny Blanc, and this is Progressing Planning, a podcast series on the role of planning on fostering change in contemporary society. Today, I'll be talking to Lindy Way-Reinert. She is a transport planner and current PhD student at the London School of Economics. In this episode, Lindy Way will talk about the role of transport planning in shaping our cities, the case for reparation in the context of public transport, and the perception of traffic enforcement in Boston.
So, Lindy Way, what role does transport planning carry in shaping our cities?
It's a big first question, but it's a good question, right? Like, for someone like me, a transport planner and someone who both works in and just loves transportation, transportation's everything. It spans like our level of access, how far in our cities we can reach, meaning like how much of the city is actually our city. It can be the great equalizer, right? Like in many cases, in many cities, it's the only time where people of all races, all income levels, all ages interact. And in that sense, it's a hugely important public space and social sphere. Kind of on the negative flip side of the coin, it can make competitors out of all of us, right? There's a limited amount of space in our cities. And when we compete for our mobility space, it can make enemies, and it makes a very us versus them situation. If you've ever been on a bicycle competing with a bus, you know what I mean. And in the past as well, it's been used, as much as I love it, in many cities as a tool of oppression, right? Like building highways can also be code for leveling neighborhoods. And we've seen the negative side of that all over the world. But for someone like me, who still very much believes in the power of transportation to do good, it's the great equalizer. It's our access, our key to the city when it's done right.
And you worked as a public sector planner with the City of Boston Transportation Department. What infrastructure investment should a city prioritize in order to combat racial and social inequalities?
That's a good question, because there's no one answer, of course. It's a mixed bag of policies. But for me, and it's important that I like keep saying for me, because we all have our blind spots and our lenses. So my lens really comes from the world of transit, public transit, right? I'm not a cycling expert, though I am a cyclist. I'm not a roadway infrastructure for private vehicle engineer, though I myself do drive occasionally, right? My lens is transit first. And without question, that shapes my answer to your question, which is that we are currently, at the world over, right? This is not just in the US context, not just in a Boston context. We are in kind of a second dawning of the age of the bus. I really think we're seeing unprecedented levels of investment and unprecedented levels of creativity in what bus-based infrastructure can look like. And I think that that needs to continue. So why bus and not rail? Why bus and not ferries? Why bus and not buying everybody autonomous vehicles? In part, it's because bus, on the one hand, is great bang for your buck, right? Like, it provides a sizable service for a huge amount of the population. It's not limited by our existing underground tunnels or where we've laid rail. It has a much more free kind of expanse given our roadways. And it's nimble, right? That's an entirely flexible service. It can adjust as demand needs for it to. But most of our buses, as kind of the US is late to figure out, much of Latin America is probably leading the charge on this one, but they are stuck in the same traffic that our private vehicles are stuck in. They are plagued by the same congestion, same environmental hazards, really, that they contribute to, as many of our non-sustainable modes. However, things like BRT, which is bus rapid transit, or bus priority treatments, which is a slightly lesser, but arguably just as effective infrastructure investment, allows our buses to have all of the benefits of bus, the flexibility, the affordability, with many of the benefits of rail, which would be the speed, the uninterrupted flow, the lack of congestion, and In doing so, we bring rail-like service to neighborhoods that have historically been disinvested in when it came to our rail laying, which gets at your piece of race. If you've been to any city, really, certainly in the US, much of Europe, much of the world, rail is a race majority serving product, infrastructure overall, and buses fill the gaps. And the gaps are code for minority neighborhoods. And so when we put our money into minority serving or minority first or low income first, just equity serving infrastructure, I think we're heading in the right direction. So if anyone were to say, you know, Lindy Way, here's the $50 million check, what's your go-to project? For me, it's going to be bus priority treatments in already probably rail serving cities that have these enormous and observable gaps. Boston is one of them.
Mm. And you worked in Boston on a matrix to assess such projects, right?
I did.
Could you tell me quickly about this?
Sure. I'm very proud of this work, actually. I had a great team at my time at the Department of Transportation in Boston, in which we took on this challenge of how do we not just solve equity problems project by project, how do we institutionalize this prioritization of kind of an attempt at correcting of past wrongdoings, right? How do we make sure that that is in our decision-making processes, in our funding allocation processes? And so we adjusted the prioritization metrics, which the city uses, not to determine which projects get done, but the order in which they get tackled, which is hugely important. And the long story short is kind of a interdisciplinary team. So not only transit planners, not only bike infrastructure planners or transportation demand modelers or HR personnel, actually, many of us kind of came in and changed this equation. And I know that it's being actively used, the updated version at the moment. And anyone in Boston would say that they have felt the changes, I believe, I hope. And I think in a few years, you know, COVID impacted budgets allowing, we will see the impacts on the ground. If you were to map where the projects starting in 2019 in Boston take place, I think it will look very different than where the projects from the, let's say, 2010 through 2019 took place. And that's down to an operationalization and a quantification of equity. Because really, if it doesn't get measured, it doesn't get done. And we knew that. So yes, race can be quantified. Yes, income can be quantified, access can be quantified, and prioritized. So I'm very proud of that work.
Yeah, this is very important and impressive. And some of your current research and past research, actually, because you told me your MSc dissertation was on this, explores reparation. Could you tell me about what reparation means to you and how can transport planning help in this?
Woof, reparations is such a huge topic. I often find myself overwhelmed by it, but I think in a nutshell, there's no wrong version of reparations, right? For me, let's start with that. I think all of the iterations that have been proposed, is it a financial payout? Sure, yes. Is it programmatic changes, right? Like, is it an investment in Black serving education? Yes. Is it an elimination of student debt? Yes. Is it subsidized housing? Yes. And I guess what my work is trying to do is only complicate the matter by adding, you know, very much inspired by Ta-Nehisi Coates' work and William Darity Jr., and just using my field to continue making a case for reparations, right? Like, we've seen the case made, of course, in the atrocities of slavery in the U.S. through Jim Crow era, through public housing policy, through the Nixon era. I mean, the oppression is endless, but the one sphere in which, you know, I look to for inspiration and work in, and I know affects all of us, that is maybe underexplored comparatively, is mobility. So I try to build the case for reparations through a transportation infrastructure lens. Part of this is historical, right? Looking at how cities and even at the federal level in the past, transportation infrastructure investment has been used as a tool of destruction of Black wealth, of Black community, of Black lives. And much of that kind of takes the form of highway construction, non-surprisingly. And then I move towards today, modern day, and looking at how, even all the way down to the pricing of public transit, like how has that, a system that is supposedly supposed to serve kind of the potentially less wealthy or the potentially less well-connected of a city, even a system that is built for us, is used disproportionately against us, right? And proving that, just coming up with examples that may be lesser known to still build the case for reparations. And a piece of that also comes into enforcement and policing, which we're seeing a lot of, and which is kind of a separate part of my research, which is within transit, what does the world of enforcement and policing look like? Is it disproportionately disenfranchising against Black people? It is, in particular, Black teens, which is very interesting, and how so many Black teens, their first entrance into the system is a violation associated with a transit system, and why that's not talked about enough, and ways to fix that. I went a little on a tangent, but to bring it back. And so once I've built this mobility-motivated case for reparations, I think if I had to pick kind of an ideal of what reparative measures actually look like, once the case is built, what is the actual tangible reparative element, I am most taken by the programmatic argument, I think, which is for me, again, framed around access, right? So which programs that allow for access can we elevate to actually give Black America not just a seat at the table, but first dibs on the microphone, you know, when it comes time to seize your platform? And I think that's the piece that's missing, is a lot of the rhetoric around the programmatic argument for reparations is like, oh, I'll get your, you know, quote unquote, foot in the door, quote unquote, seat at the table. And that's not enough. It has to go beyond. It says, not only are you in the meeting, but you're hovered around the table while potentially everyone else who used to be is snugged against the wall, right? And so in the world of transportation, I won't reveal yet what that looks like. I'm working on it, and we'll share once it's finalized. But certainly people have proposed, all right, should all transit be free for Black people? Interesting idea. You know, let's play with it. How? Why not? Let's look at that. And maybe things that aren't as blanket as that, or maybe ones that are. But I think transportation, in particular, public transit, is in a uniquely well-suited position to enact reparations that help everyone who uses the public transit system, but that in particular narrow the gap of access between Black America and America on the whole. And so, yeah, hopefully my research reveals some light in that sphere.
And we're really looking forward to hearing what this will be. So keep us in touch. So you touched upon this, but many American cities have to face the pressure of individual car traffic on their roads, and it presents challenges for cities in terms of planning and management, but also in terms of traffic regulation and law enforcement. Could you tell me a bit more about how Boston enforces this violation and how this enforcement is perceived?
Absolutely. This is a great question, in that Boston is semi-unique among its peers in how it does this, and as a result, semi-unique in its failings. But yeah, that said in jest, I love Boston very much. But at the moment, roadway infractions of almost every single type, right? So let's say red light running, let's say parking, double parking, really everything is currently enforced by in-person officers. Those officers can take different forms. So certain infractions are enforced by Boston Police Department officers in person. Other infractions are enforced by the Boston Transportation Department enforcement team. This is, for example, people who check your meters and give you a ticket if you are in violation of the parking restriction. And then certain violations are enforced by, for example, the MBTA transit cops. MBTA is the transit system provider in the greater Boston area. Their level of enforcement is much lower in that it tends to be restricted to MBTA property, whereas Boston Police Department and Boston Transportation Department have much wider restrictions over public roadways. But across the board, these infractions are enforced by in-person officers and via a ticket system. Now, that system, as you can imagine, is very hard to execute comprehensively, right? The number of officers who would have to be walking the streets, patrolling the streets to catch enough infractions, not even every violation, enough violations to have roadway users feel their presence and as a result behave more in according to the law is very difficult. That requires huge amounts of capacity and also a huge officer presence on the streets, which I'm sure both the public and those officers would argue is not what they would like to see. And so as a result, some cities do quite a bit of this enforcing in a different way. Many of them use, for certain violations, camera automated enforcement. For example, red light running in Washington, D.C., right? A city considered to be a peer of Boston in many ways, in size, in annual income earnings, even in segregation patterns, very interestingly. But in D.C., you run a red, very good chance you're getting mailed a ticket and it will be steep. But as a result, since enacting that, places like D.C., New York have seen significant improvement, meaning a decrease in violation behavior. Boston, I have found in my interviews thus far in my research, Bostonians feel very strongly and will admit themselves to regularly behaving in a way that they know is a violation of roadway rules, right? And Boston's very proud. They won't, or they haven't, hidden this fact from me in my interviews, right? Like red light running is common. Parking in bus stops, very common. Part of that is a demand and availability mismatch, a roadway availability mismatch. It's a very dense city. And the acknowledgement that the behavior is bad, the enforcement is not adequate to correct that behavior. And the third piece is that everyone I've talked to has said, but they would like to see that changed, right? There's not just an acknowledgement that the behavior is bad, there's also an acknowledgement that the bad behavior is unsafe, right? And results in negative things that the public doesn't want to see. No one wants to see someone idling in a handicap spot, knowing that the person pulling up behind them needs that spot, right? It doesn't make anyone feel good. And so my research is looking at different means of enforcement and trying to get a sense of perception, right? Who in Boston feels what way about which enforcement method is kind of the question. And does the who part of that question vary by race? Does the who part of that question vary by age, by neighborhood, which is very important in Boston? Boston's a city of many worlds of their own by neighborhood. And this very important piece, which is my hypothesis at its core, which is that the fears associated with camera automated enforcement, which are, I'm not downplaying them, they're very reasonable and significant fears, right? That of data privacy, that of the size of the ticket that's generally associated with camera enforcement is on average triple that's associated with in-person ticketing. Like, these are very genuine concerns. However, does that fear or those concerns vary by the type of infraction? And is there an equity piece there? So my thinking is Boston is currently laying down new infrastructure for sustainable modes. That includes buses, that includes bikes, even improving its rail and ferry infrastructure. And so the mode of those infrastructure investments, two of them are hyper dependent on adherence to the infrastructure, adherence to the law. That would be bus lanes and cycleways. The second you put a car in either of those, you might as well not have built the infrastructure to begin with. And in particular, those two modes are also disproportionately used by people of lower income, a larger proportion of non-white riders. And so there's this equity piece. If an individual car driven by someone of higher income and most likely a power majority is parked in a black and brown serving bus lane, you know, you feel the tension that's created here. And this contributes to what we already know to be true, which is that the statistic that's very well known now in Boston is that black riders, on average, bus riders, spend 65 hours a year more than white riders on buses. And part of that is that their distances are longer, but once you control for distance, it is still disproportionate. And a part of that is that the parts of town that they must drive through to get to activity and employment hubs are congested much more so, right? And have these higher violation rates and less enforcement rates. And so I just want to fix that mismatch, right? Like, it seems like there is a potential solution in here, but that perceptions held by those who are most at risk need to be considered. And in the case of enforcement, and in the case of the United States, that will always be Black America. So my research really focuses on perceptions of different enforcement as they relate to Black roadway users and the potential for change in that enforcement metric in Boston.
And that's another piece that we would like to hear conclusions on in the near future, hopefully.
Absolutely.
And so my last question is very broad. It's about what are your hopes for 2021? Because the American society has experienced so many challenges and changes in 2020 with the election of Joe Biden, Black Lives Matter, and COVID-19. What would you like for the American cities that you're studying to happen in the near future and in going forward?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this, actually. And I think, first and foremost, above all else, I hope that transit survives, right? Like, this is both my job, but also my true passion, and is across the country is extremely at risk at the moment. This is pandemic related more so than social tension related. And transit providers across the country are so strapped for cash, so in danger of undoing much of the good and service improvement and mode shift, meaning switching from a different means of transport to a sustainable means, to transit in particular. I'm very worried about the level of undoing of such progress. So first and foremost, I hope transit survives. I would also very much like to see, and this is without question influenced by my time at City of Boston, right, the municipal work, I would really like to see unprecedented levels. I'm talking droves of women of color in particular taking on roles of representation, representative roles of office in particular at the local level. The more Black female mayors we can have, the better. I think that is, for me, that would be the story of 2021. And not even just all the way up at mayor, you know, we're talking department heads, because that's really where the work gets done, in my opinion, in my experience in city government, that, and you feel it too, certain departments that have opened themselves up to more sizable metamorphosis. And I'm not just talking the oh so popular position that is popping up in every government department right now, which is the kind of equity and resilience and inclusion officer. That position is very much needed, and I'm glad it exists. But I would like that position to come in parallel with changes in department heads. I really think that is the key. And part of that is, in fact, my trust in some of these strong mayoral governments, my trust in local government. I think a lot of not just researchers, but people of color have low trust in government with very good reason. But in my experience, and certainly in cities like Boston, there are good minds and good work being done at that level. It just needs to be highlighted, right? And emphasized when it gets to the top, not stymied when it gets to the top. And so I do still have a shred of faith in that level of administration. I also wonder, there's the sentimental piece, right? My families, my worlds, my communities are still in the States. And apart from their advancement, apart from their kind of quote unquote success, I do worry about levels of happiness for the year 2021, right? We're seeing such a drop in morale, in mental health. I'm hoping that this pandemic has opened those of us who have been closed-minded or open-minded, but who the system of healthcare has barred from mental health, access. I'd love to see a change in that. Now is really the time for us to be changing how much of my healthcare premium I can devote by choice to not just physical, but mental health. Maybe the US needs to go to a 4-day work week. Maybe we should have longer vacations, right? This is the time for an actual revamping. And I'm worried that we're just going to be comfortable with a back to normal, right? set of standards when really, when handed a crisis, make good of it, right? Turn it into gold, turn it into something better than you could have before. And certainly we're seeing that a little bit in Boston. Boston's used this time to say, okay, we know people are getting off of public transportation. We know that physical separation is a major health concern at present, and that not everyone can just hop in their private vehicles. Let's lay down increased bikeways. You know what I mean? Let's make our bike rentals cheaper than they were before so that people can still have access to their city, still keep their expanse, but not be siloed to their metal box, right? That's an innovative move, and it has certainly allowed people who may otherwise have been trapped really by this pandemic to have some contact with the cities they love, the people they love, you know, what makes urban living worth urban living.
Yeah.
I think that's my vision for 2021.
And I hope everything you mentioned happens and that the society we're building going forward will be way better than the one it was at the start of the pandemic. That's all my questions. Is there anything else you would like to say?
Well, thank you for having me and for, you know, such great questions and being open. I know not everybody is a transit nerd, but hopefully everybody can get a little something out of this conversation. And I've really enjoyed my time chatting with you. So thank you so much for having me and for highlighting this work.
Thank you for listening to this episode, and thank you to Lindy Way Reynard for talking to us. For more information, you can visit our blog at this address, www.blog.lsc.ac.uk/progressingplanning. Thanks to the Knowledge Exchange and Impact Fund at LSC for sponsoring this episode. Next episode, we will be talking with Romola Sagnal, Associate Professor in the Department of Geography and Environment at LSC. See you soon!